7:52 a.m. on May 8, 1902, Mount Pelee on the island of Martinique in the West Indies erupted not upward but outward. And it was a glowing avalanche of lethal brew composed of superheated steam, poisonous gases mixed with clouds of incandescent volcanic ash, raced across the 5 miles to the city of St. Pierre in less than a minute. Its explosive force literally blasted down walls, uprooted trees, and tore the clothing from victims. Its searing temperature reached 1,900 degrees Fahrenheit. 29,933 people perished instantly. But there was plenty of warning. That was the amazing part about it. There was plenty of warning. As early as April 25th, the mountain awoke with a vast cloud of rock and ashes. And then the Roxelane River flowed a gray mud. And 20 bodies were seen floating down that muddy river, and four times as many animals. The earth tremors actually disrupted the telephone services. By May 2nd, thunderous explosions rocked the city and covered it with whitish ash like snow. The city officials met. You can almost feel the tension in the room as they met. Evacuation was suggested, and they could have left the city. But no, there was an important election coming up. The mayor voiced an objection to evacuating the city, and I'm quoting, this is an exact quote. "There is medical evidence to show that sulfur can be beneficial to chest and throat complaints." End quotes. The endorsement of this remarkable diagnosis came from a prominent businessman, and incidentally, he was a casket maker. "Since the ash had fallen, he personally," and this is another quote, "I have found I can breathe easier than I have done before, by holding a handkerchief across my nose and mouth to filter the fumes. The fumes," he said, "reduced the humidity in the air and could be of no danger to human beings." That the fumes had killed animals, he explained, and animals and birds both, he said, because they have a different breathing system than ours. So 6 days later, after this meeting, 30,000 people perished, nearly that many, because of false assurances based on self-interest. Now, throughout history, denial and cover-up has encompassed much of humanity's endeavor to avoid the truth. Now, we live in a media-oriented age, time, where bits and pieces of information are bombard us every day. And these little fragments may carry truth, but far too often is only partial and sometimes downright lies. People go into court. They raise their right hand, tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. But far too often, every obfuscation and disingenuous methods known to man are used to avoid finding the truth. Facts can be molded and shaped into all sorts of appealing things to promote a product or to sell political or religious or scientific agenda. I brought along a quotation from Dr. Pinnock. He says, science is far from neutral. Evolution is her controlling concept, the framework which she assumes and within which she works. What my net won't catch isn't fish. If the facts will not fit my theory, so much for the facts. Evolution succeeds not because it is a sound theory, but because it bolsters a humanistic faith which a modern man has foolishly adopted in place of the Christian gospel. It persists despite nature, not because of her. Even the church, which has long referred to the Seventh-day Adventist message as, quote, the truth, gets caught up in the addictive joy of popularity and progress reports that bend the truth. I'm going to share something with you that I've never said in public, but it illustrates what I'm saying here. Back in the mid-70s, you remember when we used to get these reports, how many food baskets you passed out, how many pieces of literature, how many Bible studies, especially the youth. Now, these reports would come into the conference, then to the union, and then to the general conference. And I was in the general conference, and these reports would come in, and of course, then they would distribute to the Review and Herald, and everybody would see the great progress. Our dear youth, carrying the message, is going to finish quickly. Well, one day, about 20 years ago, I was in an advisory, North American advisory. All the youth leaders and the union leaders were there. Time for the report. Brother, what's your report? Now, one man had the temerity, or he at least had the boldness to stand up, and he cleared his throat, and he says, I've got to tell you something. I have been fabricating these reports. I make up numbers. I tell my secretary, what was our last report? And she says, it was so many thousand. And he says, well, just add, you know, another 2,000 or 3,000 to that, and moving it on up. You could have heard a pin drop. And then the next man got up and he says, I've been doing the same thing for years. And the next one, and I can assure you, mandibles were moving, but nothing was coming out. It was an amazing revelation. Unconsciously, many have missed the truth of the gospel and have reduced it down to bodies, bucks, and bricks. I was preaching one time in a church on Matthew 24:14. This gospel shall be preached in all the world for a witness. And I made the remark, I said, supposing you baptized everybody in the world as a Seventh-day Adventist, Muslims and Methodists and Buddhists and Baptists, all of them, atheists, agnostics, and they were all baptized, every man, woman, and child in the entire world. The thought even staggers you because you can think of the rush on veggie food alone. But just supposing, and I said, but the work would not necessarily be finished. And a doctor met me outside the church. He says, what you preach is heresy. Then he took me by the lapel and pulled me closer. He says, but it's the truth. It's the truth. We desperately need to become acquainted with the God of truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus said. Now, about a year and a half before his crucifixion, during the Feast of Tabernacles in AD 30, Jesus had a head-to-head confrontation with those in authority. You remember the occasion. It is actually recorded, and I hope you have your Bibles open to John 8. over who he was. The confrontation was over who he was and the purpose of his mission. And during this confrontation, he boldly told them that they were liars. That would not really float too well today, I suppose, but that's what he told them. You are their father, the devil. The dictates of the first liar, Satan himself. At the close of this dramatic exchange, Jesus told them of his claim of divinity, and he says, I am. And they took up stones to kill him. But in the midst of this confrontation, Jesus made a declaration that is so pertinent for our times. And I want to read again. He read from the New International Version. I want to read from the King James Version. Follow along now again in the midst of this confrontation. Then said Jesus unto them, when ye have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall ye know that I am he, that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father hath taught me, I speak these things. And he that sent me is with me. And the Father hath not left me alone, for I do always those things that please him. As he spake these words, many believed on him. Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, if ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The New International Version says, the truth shall set you free. Now notice the prediction in verse 28. When ye have lifted up the Son of Man, this is prior to the crucifixion. And although the concept of a suffering Messiah was really quite foreign to the Jews, it says many believed. Now, even if they did not quite understand what this involved, many believed on Jesus. Now, the heart of God's message centers on the cross. The sacrifice of Christ as an atonement for sin is the great truth around which all other truths cluster. If you really analyze it, I don't care whether you're talking about the second coming, I don't care whether you're talking about what happens to the dead, all the truths cluster around the cross. Now, we often take too narrow a view of the cross. Not only did his death make an atonement for each one of us here this morning for sin, but it accomplished much more than that. Christ's death established the perpetuity of the law once and for all, in spite of what's being said today in many, many circles. If the law could have been abolished, he did not need to die. That's the truth. In fact, when I was a young soldier going into combat, I overheard a Bible study. I was studying down in the mess deck. They call it the mess deck. That's where the cafeteria is, of course. And I would listen to this Bible study because I was intrigued with the scriptures. And there was a young fellow there that says, the law was abolished. Christ died. And the man that was studying with me was very calm. That's what I always admired about him. He was so calm. And he let him spew out. Pretty soon he stopped and he held up his hand like this and he says, all right, let's say this is the preacher. The thumb is the preacher. What is he supposed to be preaching? And by the way, he asked him to answer. He says he's supposed to be preaching the gospel. He had a high voice. I can remember, irritating voice. All right, this is the gospel. And what is the gospel about? It's about Jesus Christ. All right, this is Christ. And what did he come to do? He came to save sinners. This is sin. And what is sin? And I think he saw the noose kind of slipping over his head. He says, the transgression of the law. So he says, all right, we're going to do exactly what you said. We're going to take the law away. If there's no law, there's no sin. There's no sinners. Then there's no sinners, there's no need of Christ, no need of Christ, there's no gospel. And then he took his thumb and wiggled it right underneath his nose and he says, and this preacher doesn't have much to say. I can remember him jumping up and down and he says, you can't fool me with those little finger plays. But I can assure you, it left an impression. That's over 50 years ago. The truth is that if we all kept the law of out of love, there would be real freedom. It is a law of liberty. You wouldn't have to lock your doors. You wouldn't have to carry on the way you do. You'd be free to walk. But Satan has sold the people on a bill of goods that every time you obey, it's legalism. That's a lie. That's a lie. There is legalism, trying to earn you credit. But obedience is not equated with legalism. He shuffled the cards for the people. Christ's death on the cross also established God's eternal purpose in restoring humanity. It is more than forgiveness, much more. Because, you see, creation and recreation are closely linked in the gospel. He forgives you, yes, but he restores you, brings you into oneness with him. But the truth is, Christ's death had even a wider and more comprehensive purpose. Redemption includes the vindication of God's name to an onlooking universe. You see, he's been challenged. He has been challenged by forces that we can't see. In our prayer this morning, we heard Dr. Neil Nedley saying about the forces of beyond our scope of understanding. Satan and his hosts have challenged God. God's name is at stake. The question is, was God self-sacrificing? And I like these words in Desire of Ages 5:58. To the angels and the unfallen worlds, the cry, "It is finished," had a deep significance. Now, we're talking about the unfallen worlds. We're not talking about poor sinners down here. We're talking about the unfallen worlds. We're talking about the angels, the good angels. "It is finished," Jesus said. It was for them, as well as for us, that the great work of redemption had been accomplished. They with us share the fruits of Christ's victory. That is the truth. It proved Satan was a liar. And he was placed on death row. He's finished. He's active now. But like, you remember a few years ago when they had the Alcatraz, the federal penitentiary was in use. There were some criminals that escaped, some felon escaped from one ward to the next ward. They're doomed. But they got a hold of some guns and they shot up as many guards and as many people as they could. And Satan is doomed. He's on death row. He's locked up. He's not going anywhere. This is not going to proliferate to the rest of the universe. What we do here is confined to this universe, to this world. Now, when John speaks of truth in his gospel, he uses it in a wider sense, not just facts. Things pertaining to God and the duties of man. He includes that. Now, the Jews objected to this idea, the truth will make you free. Notice in verse 33, they answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, ye shall be made free?" Now, they must have had a lapse of memory because my Bible tells me about the times they were in bondage. They must be reading some other page because they were in bondage several times. And what about the times during the judges? What about the time when the northern tribe of Israel was taken by the Assyrians? What about the tribe Judah, the southern tribe? They're taken to Babylon. what about the time they were right in? They were under the Romans. But when people are determined not to believe the truth, they become blinded and they want to rewrite history to fit their own agenda. We are never in bondage to any man. Now notice what Jesus answered. In verse 34, Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin." Now we're talking about bondage, not some outside force coming. But if you are in sin and holding to sin and clinging to it, you are the servant of sin and you are in bondage. And right here, right at this verse, is the problem begins with many. God does nothing in partnership with Satan. "He that is not with me is against me," Jesus said. Now we hear much today about God's unconditional love, and I would not want to diminish that in the least. But the truth is, there's no salvation is possible without our cooperation in unconditional surrender. You can talk all you want to about God's unconditional love, but there must be a response from you unconditionally. Jesus said plainly, and I'm reading from Luke 9:23, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." Now, many people today would like to take out some white out and wipe that out. Take up my cross daily? And follow him? Now the cross is a symbol of death to self. A willingness to die to all the passions and desires and the times when you get angry at your spouse or the times when you got to have it your way or the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. All this is self. And it requires divine aid because suicide by crucifixion is impossible. You have to be willing. And all we bring into the equation is our will. Now, the interesting thing about the death to self, we talk about it. We don't get down to the real part about it. Supposing today, instead of inviting me here for the service, that we had a funeral for Brother Doward. And the casket was right here. And he said, "You can review the remains." You come by and somebody whispers and says, "I never really liked him." And you'd see a frown on my face. You'd nudge, "You know, I don't think he's gone." And somebody said, "Oh, he really turned me on. I really liked it. You see his smile. I don't think he's gone." And he wouldn't be. You'll notice something about the life of Jesus. He was never elated by applause nor dejected by censure. He received his joy, his motivation in bringing people to the Heavenly Father. And he was above this. When we actually are dead to self, it is easy living. It's a strange paradox. You're not annoyed by these other things. I'm not standing up here and telling you I've arrived. I know what I'm talking about. You are above it. Now, how does this work? It comes at the very moment of temptation. When you get to wiggling, you know, my jaws begin to go back and forth. And I can feel the blood pressure coming. You know what works? When tempted, you say, "He cares for me. He makes intercession for me. He loves me. He died for me. I will give myself unreservedly to him. And that is what James is talking about when he says, submit yourself to God and resist the devil and he will flee from you. Do you know that those silent petitions go up and baffle the enemy? He can't read your mind. It baffles him. He knows, Satan knows, that the weakest person clinging to Jesus is more than a match for him. That's the reason why he's in the diversionary tactics. He has to get you diverted on things. Whatever it may be on the television, whatever it may be here or there, get diverted. There's a big problem in the church. There's a big argument here, big argument there. Get diverted. Don't get in the Word. Whatever it is, don't get into the Word. And don't turn to Jesus. He knows. And how can we know such an unconditional surrender has taken place? Well, I read something from Ellen White that I want to share with you. No conversion is genuine which does not change both the character and the conduct of those who accept the truth. It has to change both. Now, through the ages, this has been a source of contention. Those who have never experienced true conversion or maintain it by the grace of God will be in conflict with the truly converted. It'll happen again and again and again. Go back there to the time when Cain and Abel were together, these brothers. They both worshipped. They both came before God. But Cain was going to do it his way. And Abel said, I must do it the way God wanted me to do it because I love him. The history of the early church is pockmarked with conflict with the nominal Christians and the true. The rise of the papacy occurred on the basis of accommodation to the half-converted pagans, and the long night of struggle began in earnest. It makes no difference whether you're discussing the wearing of jewelry or dress or music or diet or recreation, the truth is the carnal mind is at enmity against God and will always be at enmity against God until it comes to Jesus to be transformed. The truth will set you free. But it must be remembered that in order to arrive at truth, and I'm reading now from Steps to Christ, page 116. In order to arrive at truth, we must have a sincere desire to know the truth and a willingness to obey it. That's how we find out what truth is. Now, Paul commanded Timothy, counseled him and told him to rightly divide the word of truth. And that's the problem with so many people. They take one little isolated text, never read fore and aft, and they come up with some wrong conclusion. Sincere, but sincerely wrong. Now, I gave this illustration about 14 years ago in the same sanctuary, but some of you weren't here, and I'm going to repeat this because it illustrates what I'm talking about. I heard M.L. Andreessen, the dear old saint who really came to know the Bible and the spirit of prophecy. And I heard him tell one time when he first became a Seventh-day Adventist, he was sincere, eager, and he opened up the testimonies to the church. And he read a line, "You eat too much." So he cut his food intake in half. But there it was. You eat too much. So he cut it again. But there it was. You eat too much. He cut it again. He said, I got down to granola and water. And then one day he went by a fruit stand and he saw some grapefruit. And he was so hungry for citrus fruit that he bought a grapefruit. And he ate that grapefruit. And after he ate it, the citric acid began to work. And he got a little sore here. And he says, it's a judgment of the Lord. No. Then he talked to us about common sense and about rightly dividing the word. Now, God has given us ample warning in His Word regarding the dangers of turning from the truth. And I'd like to have you go to 2 Thessalonians 2, 8-12. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8-12. This is where Paul is talking about the rise of the mystery of iniquity. And he says, "And then shall the wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of His mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of His coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for the same, and for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they might be damned, who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." Now this is very similar to God hardening Pharaoh's heart. The reaction. God sends the truth, and if they resist, something happens. You know, when I used to teach the young people, and I have at least one person here that was in my Bible class years and years ago, 30 years ago, I used to tell them, "Do you want to see a picture of the human soul?" "Oh, yeah." So I went to the blackboard and I drew a great big circle. And then I drew a lot of other circles inside. Little small ones, different sizes. Now I got their attention. "This is going to be a picture of a human soul." And I said, "All these holes, like Limburger cheese, are entrance to the heart, the mind, the sights, the sounds, everything." And I said, "God speaks to you and says, 'Child of mine, you'd be better if you didn't watch that.'" "No, I like that program, or I like that music." I says, "Then something happens." And I erased one of the holes. And we went through the whole thing, little by little, until finally there's one hole left. And God cannot reach the person once that hole is stopped. That's the reason why Jesus cried. And He says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you've killed the prophets." He walked out of the temple that Tuesday evening, tears streaming down His face. "Resist." So the moving of the Holy Spirit. I heard a story of a call porter talking to a lady. This is up north here. And he told her, he said, "Do you know the seventh day is the Sabbath? Saturday. I don't believe it. It's not in my Bible." He said, "Would you get me your Bible?" So she got him the Bible. He read it to her. She looked down. She tore the page out. "It's not in my Bible anymore." Now that's a little blunt, but some of the theologians can do kind of mental gymnastics or ecclesiastical hurdles here and do the same thing, but it's rather interesting how people react. The great tragedy for many, which ends in eternal damnation, is the fact that their resistance to the truth confirms them in iniquity. Why is it that falsehood and error are accepted in the place of Christ and His gospel and the biblical truth? Why is that? It is the love, and I'm quoting here from Desire of Ages, it is the love of self, the desire for an easier way than God has appointed, that leads to the substitution of human theories and traditions for the divine precepts. One religious writer says, "An evil power comes with error, goes with error. There is something in error that finds an echo within man's sinful heart, and it becomes popular, chiefly because it does not call for sacrifices to be made in its acceptance. It is an idea that requires no crucifying of self, but rather panders to self. This is why people cling tenaciously to the first lie of the natural immortality of the soul. And it's everywhere. It's in Reader's Digest. It's in all the magazines. It's everywhere. It just permeates. The lie won't go away. A host of other errors that range from Sunday sacredness to the secret rapture to glossolalia. This is also why the anthropomorphic ideas are so popular about God. They make God in their own image after their own likeness. It invariably leads to a pseudo-worship and a terrible irreverence. This is why biblical terminology has been rewritten to suit the tastes of the cosmetic Christian community. Compassion has turned into meaning a false sympathy for the sinner, which entrenches the sinner into sin rather than lifts the sinner up from sin. There's a counterfeit for every part of the Christian gospel, and compassion is turned into this idea of sympathizing for the sinner. The real Jesus saves people from their sins, not in their sins. This is why love is dwelt upon as a chief attribute of God, but it leaves out His law and His justice always. And if you look carefully, if you look really carefully, it is spiritualistic to the core. The voice of seducing spirits and the doctrines of devils. Be wary of any preacher or teacher who wants to take out God's law and His justice away from His love, and then you have nothing but sentimentality. Now, Christ opposed the religious leaders of His day, not for any good that He had done, but the fact that He systematically exposed their error and their falsehood. The conservative Pharisees saw their elaborate concepts of salvation completely demolished. The liberal Sadducees, with their pseudo-intellectualism and so-called science, saw him utterly undermine their false system. And so the both of them, the conservatives and the liberals, got together in their hatred of Jesus, crucify Him. There's another way. The ancient prophets were not persecuted or killed for their appearance or bad breath, but because they spoke the truth. Ellen White, God's gracious gift of prophecy that is so often despised, and because her writings are not hard to understand, but because they cross the carnal mind and the sin-loving heart. How well I know, time and time again in my ministry, I've run across this. One time I was preaching on the topic of religious liberty, the separation of church and state, and right in the middle of the sermon, a man called out, "I don't believe that!" And it shook me up a little bit. I didn't know where I was. And I had just read a quotation from Ellen White, and I couldn't figure out what religious liberty, what's the matter? So I said, when I regained my composure, I said, "I'll talk to you later, brother." When I talked to him with the local elder, we sat down together, and I said, "What seems to be the problem?" "You quoted from Ellen White." "Yes." "Well, I don't like Ellen White. She tells me not to eat meat, and I like my meat." It had nothing to do with religious liberty. It's amazing. Amazing. She didn't speak in Swahili. That's the problem. The Apostle Paul predicted our very moment in history when he wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 4, 3 and 4, and I'm reading from the New International Version, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside the myths." We must remember, and remember it well, our condemnation and the judgment will not result from the fact that we have been in error, but from the fact that we neglected heaven-sent opportunities for learning what is truth. We are now on the very brink of eternity. right on the edge. And we need to learn the truth about Jesus, the truth about the message he has on the character of God, and not only be prepared for his coming, but I'd like to have your mind go way up ahead after he comes to the end of the 1,000 years. I'd like to have you think about that this morning, because there'll be one grand prayer meeting. You see, that is one time in the entire universe, both the righteous and the wicked, Satan and his hosts and the good angels, Gabriel and all of them, all the unfallen worlds, everybody will be on their knees and they'll say, "Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints." They will acknowledge the justice, the mercy, that everything was according to the way he had planned. And there on the outside of the holy city will be Cain, he who let his mind run in the same channel of Satan's. Abel will be on the inside, he who responded to God's love and obeyed the law. And there will be Esau, who loved self-gratification and the soul, his sole interest was in the present. He'll be on the outside. And his brother Jacob, who learned what true repentance was all about and became an overcomer, will be on the inside of the city. Judas, whoever retained self, that one part of self, his covetousness, is the very epitome of those who say, "Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in thy name? Didn't we do these many wonderful things?" He did. Jesus sent Judas out with the others to heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, to cast out devils. But Judas will be on the outside of the city. Judas will be. He never surrendered his life totally to Christ. But John, the beloved, we call him. He was nicknamed, he and his brother, the Sons of Thunder. They had a temper. But the closer he came to Jesus, the more he felt the transforming power of that love, and he was changed, transformed into a man that will be on the inside, while his colleague will be on the outside. Each person will know exactly where and how and why they made their choice. Those on the inside will understand that the truth has set them free for eternity, while those on the outside will realize that hell is truth seen too late.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.